This is a podcast from ABC Overnights. Here's Trevor Chappell.
Max Allen, wine writer, journalist and the author of Intoxicating, 10 Drinks That Shaped Australia. Hello, Max.
Good morning.
Good to talk to you.
Nice to be here.
And thank you for being up at this time of the day.
That's all right. Can't remember the last time I was up this this late. It's happened in the past a couple of times.
Max, one of the things that I noticed in the book is we did a program the other day about the Macassans, and I was interested to see that the Macassans were the first people to bring alcohol to Australia and not the Europeans with rum.
This was one of the motivations for writing this book, is learning that the story of grog in Australia goes back way, before 1788. You're right. The Macassans would come down from Indonesia, from Java, and bring a drink called arak, or as they called it, anich, which was a pronunciation of the word anise or aniseed, So if you can imagine that licorice-y flavour that you find in a lot of arak in Indonesia, it's quite a fiery spirit. It was drunk by the Macassans and by many people across Southeast Asia for hundreds of years before 1788. And you're right, the Macassans, every year they'd come down to Australia looking for trepang or sea cucumber, and they bring they live in Arnhem Land for months at a time and live with the Yolngu people and work with the Yolngu people and trade with the Yolngu people. And one of the things they brought with them was this drink, arak, which you read stories like that and it completely turns on its head your thoughts about alcohol in Australia.
What I found fascinating, because for a long time I, as many people had, was under the belief that Indigenous people in Australia didn't produce any fermented drinks and that there was no alcohol. But when you take a look at what you've written, there was fermented drinks in a lot of Indigenous communities right across the country.
Again, that was the motivation for writing the book. Really, was to try and tell some of those stories, and then link it to some of the renewed interest in Indigenous ingredients today in food and drink. So, again, you go back to the 17th century, and Dutch sailors wrote stories about arriving in Western Australia. So, again, this is long before the English, and they saw Indigenous people in southwestern Western Australia, the Noongar people, would take Banksia cones. So these amazing, if anybody who's spent time in that part of the country will know that the giant Banksias have these huge Banksia flower cones that are, the size of, about a foot tall, these amazing yellow cones full of nectar. And they would put these Banksia cones into troughs full of water, and the nectar would come out into the water, and they'd keep piling these Banksia flowers in, and the nectar would make this water sweet. Now, that Banksia drink was drunk right across Australia, wherever Banksias are grown, but the Noongar people and other Aboriginal people across Australia would let this sweet liquid ferment and then drink it as a kind of probably about 3%, 4% alcohol drink that tasted a bit like honey mead, which has been drunk, in other parts of the world for thousands of years.
And with it, because it was mainly ceremonial, and so it wasn't a matter of drinking for fun, it was mainly ceremonial, as similarly done with the cider gum?
Yes, and that was the one that really attracted me. I'm a big fan of cider. I make my own cider in my backyard every year from apples that I manage to scrounge off people, because I'm really rubbish at growing anything, So I let other people do the growing, and I go and get the apples and make my own cider. So when I read about the cider gum, it's a drink called Wayalina that Tasmanian Aboriginal people have been making for who knows how long. And it's the sap of the cider gum tree from the really cold central parts of Tasmania up in the highlands. And the sap naturally flows out of this tree. I mean, I managed to travel to an Aboriginal-owned part of Tasmania where these cider gums grow, and you walk through this country and you think, you know, it must have just felt like nature was providing you with this beautiful tasting drink that literally just flows. I mean, it trickles more than flows out of the sap, out of the bark of the cider gum tree. It naturally pulls this liquid, and again, it just naturally ferments. You know, wherever there is sugar in the world, in a liquid form that's liquid enough for yeasts to start acting on the sugar, you will get alcohol. And so, as you say, that it's something that was, it only happens at a certain time of the year. So people would gather and they would have ceremonies connected to the consumption of this alcohol.
Why is it that we didn't hear more about it? Because as you said, it's not as if there wasn't information written about these drinks before, but it's still something that we don't hear a heck of a lot about.
I think there's two reasons. There's a whole, just, we could talk all day about all the aspects of Aboriginal culture that we weren't aware of until relatively recently, partly because we didn't ask the questions, partly because these things, you know, weren't shared widely. I think one of the main reasons is I haven't come across one of these drinks that you could commercialise very easily. Right, so, you know, look at the interest now in Indigenous foods that are being commercialised. The macadamia nut, for example, which is, you know, known around the world, originally an Australian nut that was successfully commercialised. And I think one of the reasons was, you know, all these drinks that we've talked about are seasonal, relatively low alcohol, not something that you could easily grow anywhere else, like the cider gum tree, for example. Unlike grapevines from Europe, which grow well in many places around the world, the cider gum only grows in a very, very specific cold environment to produce this sap. So you could go and buy a cider gum tree from a nursery anywhere, you could grow it in your backyard, and it will grow, and it prefers cooler climates to warmer climates. So you can grow it on, you know, I'm in Melbourne, you can grow it around Melbourne, no problem, but it doesn't produce this sap. It hasn't got the right environmental conditions. So I think that's one of the reasons why we haven't heard about it, because it hasn't become a commercial drink.
Well, take some calls. We're going to take calls from people this morning about the drinks that shaped these Australians, and we'll talk a little bit about those as well. Bev's called. Hello, Bev.
I go back to the 1940s, just after the war. I was born in 1941, but by the time I was about 8 or 10, we used to visit Nana, if she wasn't at home, opposite Mars Pub in South Melbourne. We went to Mars Pub and saw her there because she enjoyed the odd tipple. And the different drinks I can remember at that age were, there was a mixed wine that used to be very cheap, and that was cheap and nasty, but it was called Fourpenny Dark.
Yeah.
That's one. The other one was Stout or Portergaff, which was stout with lemonade in it.
Yep.
Quite often I was introduced to a little thimble of shandy that my mother used to drink. We used to get a little whiskey glass given to me.
Hey, Bev, were they for medicinal purposes only?
Oh, gosh, no.
I was wondering whether or not the stout was.
Oh, well, some people would make the excuse, but I did love the taste of stout. I used to get a little sip every now and then, but if I was good and quiet.
Look, thank you, because the medicinal purpose was always used for many things, Max. It could have been for brandy was for medicinal purposes, stout was for medicinal purposes.
And I love the way that the memory of drinking these drinks takes people back to a certain time and a certain place and connects them with loved ones in the past. And that was, again, very much one of the reasons for writing the book. You know, over the last 30 years, I've been writing about various drinks, but I've been interested in drinks for a lot longer than that. And I've just got these very strong memories of drinking associated with family and friends and places I've been. And that idea that stout or alcohol, Portergaff, have you heard that?
I've been in Portergaff for years.
Yeah, that's right. And Fourpenny Dark and the idea that drinking is good for you. One of the chapters in the book is about a type of bitters that was made 100 years ago. And it was advertised as being particularly good for, you know, pretty much whatever ails you. You know, it was, let me just find it here. It said, that you know, it was very good for things like flatulence if you if you drank a little bit of this bitters every day. And Bev's absolutely right that a lot of this was just marketing, you know. It comes from a very, very deep tradition of alcohol being associated with you know, apothecaries and people that made you better, and the tradition of healing alcohol. But it was something that by the time, you know, a lot of these drinks were being sold 100 years ago or less, it was very much about trying to sell more rather than trying to make you feel better.
Is that where we got lemon? Is that where the lemon, lime and bitters? Was that the bitters?
Yes, exactly. So that's that little dash of bitters at the end, which gives lemon, lime and bitters its kind of pink colour. It was a locally produced version of that here in Australia that was meant to be good for you. If you have a little taste of that every night.
That was because one of my first memories of anything alcoholic was the belief that if you drank enough lemon, lime and bitters that you might get drunk. And so I think it was at the golf club, everyone would drink as much lemon, lime and bitters as they possibly could.
Yeah, by the time you got drunk, you would probably also explode from too much liquid, I reckon.
Bruce, hello.
Hello, how are you going?
Good, Bruce.
That lemon, lime and bitters reminds me of a lot of people that used to go to the RSL. And they say, no, we're not drinking, but they'd get them to put... make a lemon, lime and bitters for them, and they'd get about 20, 30, 40 drops of bitters in it.
I don't know if that would make any difference either. You're of Italian descent. What was it for you, Bruce?
And if you know your bitters, it's what, about 60% alcohol.
Do you remember Italian people over the road?
Yes, I do. When I was five, I moved into Northbourne. We had a lovely Italian family across the road. And there was a boy at the same age as me. And every Sunday, I was invited over for lunch. But from the age of five, beautiful pasta, beautiful food was magnificent.
And what did they drink, Bruce?
Well, we were given a glass of homemade vino. Now, this is the wine, not the grappa. It's not the still. And most people wouldn't drink, but with pasta, it was beautiful. It just went with it.
Bruce, thank you, because I've got another text here that says grappa for medicinal purposes only. I've got a couple of texts about Grappa Max, and there's a huge tradition there of homemade strong spirits.
When I was working on this book, it was very important right at the beginning that I include this tradition of homebrew. one of the reasons for that is anybody can go on to Google or whatever and search the records for, you know, all the historic and famous drinks that we all know. You know, I also include a chapter in here on unquestionably Australia's most famous beer brand, for example, because I think that's really important to look at the commercial history of drinking in Australia. But it was really important that we had a chapter on homebrew in the book, because it's the stories that don't appear in the records but appear in people's memories and lives and families, traditions like Bruce's memory I love that story. I remember when I tasted the first homebrew that a great friend of mine helped his dad make every year. They were from Sicily originally, and you know, the pride that this bloke who has this family tradition of making his homemade wine, you know, he'd bring a bottle to a party and share it with, and it wasn't the best wine in the world, but it didn't matter because it meant something to him, and it was really special to him, that connection with his father and his family. So I think homebrew is a really, really important part of the Australian tradition. There's bottling parties that people of a certain generation will remember going up to the wineries in Rutherglen or McLaren Vale and bringing home pretty much like a barrel of wine and having a home bottling party where everybody gets together and bottles this wine for themselves. And that stuff doesn't appear on the record anyway. You know, it's oral tradition. It's people's stories.
Apart from Bundaberg rum, I didn't realise that Australia had such a strong distilling history, that there was a whiskey producer in Corona Rye. I didn't realise that there were all of these places that were making gin and all sorts of things.
It's easy to think that the whiskey tradition in Australia is about 20 years old, when people like Bill Lark in Tasmania started making small batch single malt, you know, 20 years ago. But it doesn't. There was a point in the 1940s, I think it was. Australia's always been a big whiskey drinking nation. We love our spirits here, as anybody, as everybody knows. And Bundaberg is one of those distilleries that's been going pretty much consistently since the late 19th century. But in the 1940s, we drank heaps and heaps of whiskey. And about 40% of the whiskey we drank in Australia was homemade. It was homegrown, home produced. And Corio was a massive distillery. It's still there. It's this huge three-story brick building that's right near the refinery there in Corio. If you drive down from Melbourne to Geelong, it's just north of Geelong, the whole suburb called Corio. And the distillery, the building is still there. It's empty, unfortunately. The stills are quiet. These huge, big copper pot stills are still sitting inside the building unused. And it was a massive producer of whiskey and I've been lucky enough to taste some of those whiskies dating back to the 1960s, and the 1960s whiskey is still drinking really well. And you're right, gin, whiskey, vodka, it was all being produced in Australia back in the day. And then because of commercial consolidation, because of changes in global drinking patterns, by the 1980s, a lot of that stuff had disappeared. So that the current generation of drinkers, you know, anybody 50 or younger would have grown up thinking that there was no strong spirits tradition in Australia apart from rum. But it's not true.
Hello, Wayne.
Oh, hi, Trevor Mack. When I was studying early philosophy some years ago, we discussed the apple in the Garden of Eden in the Bible as the fruit that was used because you could make apple cider from it. And the reason that was important is because alcohol, cider, could alter states of consciousness. And it was that ability to sort of, you know, get in touch with, whatever, dreams, God, that was important in alcohol being produced, because it could alter states of consciousness. And medicinally, in Sydney, there was a doctor at Sydney Hospital in the 1870s, Dr. Frascati. He was of Italian descent, and he didn't like all the drugs and potions that were being used to sedate people. So he went up to Mudgee and he planted grapes up there at a vineyard called St. Augustine's Vineyard.
Hmm.
And he used to use the wine from there as a sedative for patients at Sydney Hospital. And when he died, his family erected the pig out the boar outside Sydney Hospital, because that was the motif on the wine. And it was produced right up until the late 1990s, when Southport bought up a lot of vineyards up at Mudgee, and we lost an important part of our heritage again.
And what a great story, Max.
And it's in the book. Thank you, Anne. That's a great the slice of Australian wine and medical history. There's so much to unpack in what Anne just said. Thomas Fiaschi's vineyard in Mudgee. He was an incredible character, Fiaschi. He also fought for the Italians in Abyssinia, for example, and he recommended claret and hock, as Anne said, to be given to his. He gave a lecture to a group of nurses and expounded at length at the different types of wine that should be used to kind of help treat different ailments. But this idea of the apple, that hadn't occurred to me before, actually. That yes, we all know that the apple was the fruit in the Garden of Eden in the stories that have come down to us in the Bible, but perhaps it's the use of the apple, turning it into apple cider and becoming alcoholic, that actually is what the serpent was. You know, maybe it was the cider that ruined everything for us all in the Garden of Eden. That hadn't occurred to me before.
I've got a text here that says, Brandovino, baby, still have fond memories of that drop, even though you sometimes had a few regrets. Brandovino was the thing from my teenage years. But we also have a bit of a thing about fortified wines, and that's been going along for quite a long time, Max.
The Fourpenny Dark that Bev mentioned at the a couple of callers ago was a fortified wine that was very popular back in the day, and I love the name of that drink. Somebody should bring that back, Fourpenny Dark, although it wouldn't mean anything to young people these days. Yes, fortified wine for most of the 20th century was the number one style of wine produced in Australia and drunk in Australia. It was only really in the 60s and 70s and the wine boom that table wine, so wine that's only around, 12, 13%, as opposed to fortified wine, which has had spirit added to it to fortify it, to strengthen it, so port, sherry, that kind of thing, were by far the most popular styles of wine in Australia.
Why is that?
Partly because that's what we the climate produces. So, in those regions like Rutherglen that I mentioned before in northeast Victoria, or McLaren Vale, Barossa in South Australia, Swan Valley next to Perth, those are pretty warm regions and they produce very strong styles of wine traditionally. Also, in the late 19th century, when those wine regions were being established, fortified wine was a lot more popular than it is today, so that's what those regions produced. But also, very importantly, England, which has always been a really important export market for Australia, what they wanted from Australia were strong styles of wine like port. So a lot of regions, McLaren Vale is a good example in South Australia, just south of Adelaide, a lot of the grape varieties that grow there, like Grenache, for example, which is enjoying a bit of a renaissance of popularity at the moment, that was grown in McLaren Vale back in the day to produce port for English consumers.
Is that why a lot of the early table wines were sweet white wines? I've got someone sent a text saying Porphyry Pearl, Barossa Porphyry Pearl. Yeah. I think Benin Moselle as well. Is that why we saw some of those sweeter wines early?
No, those wines are very much an invention of the 50s and 60s. Mm. So, as I said before, there was this kind of cultural revolution in the 50s around the time of the Olympics, 1956, where a lot of European migrants were coming into Australia and kind of changing the way we saw ourselves as Australians, as a more multicultural society. And as women began to really, feel the benefits of social, more progressive attitudes towards equality in society, people like winemakers realised that there was an emerging market in young women. When Bev was talking before about going to visit a nan in South Melbourne, a lot of the times in pubs, women weren't really welcome in the same section of the pub as the blokes, right? There was this segregation of men and women in drinking circles. That all began to kind of break down and change in the 50s and 60s. And as a result, those sweeter, lighter styles of wine, like Porphyry Pearl, Benin, Moselle, which people would remember if they were drinking in the 60s and 70s and 80s, were developed and were a huge hit. And they really helped to kind of change our approach to wine in this country. We stopped drinking fortifieds, we started drinking table wines, partly because of those lighter, sweeter styles of wine.
Lloyd, hello.
Yes, good evening. Well, good morning to you. Medicinal port and brandy. After listening to Richard Feidler's program on the radio the other day about the opium trade, apparently the medicinal wines and, well, not wines, port and whiskey was fortified with opium to help relieve pain, because they said if you have a good glass of that before you go to bed and you'll sleep very well and you won't have any pain.
That'd work quite well, Max.
Yeah, you're right, absolutely. There was this idea of tonic wine, and I think there were some examples in the late 19th, early 20th century of it wasn't just grapes going into those products. I don't know about maybe cocaine. Yes, maybe, who knows.
How early were we making beer? You meant talk about VB, but there was a lot of, I mean, every state had their major beer label and some cities as well. How early were we making beer?
There were attempts to make beer right at the beginning. The big problem, unlike grapes, which grow pretty well in the kind of climates that were being colonised in the early days, so around Sydney, the first vineyards were planted in 1788, tiny little plantings of vines, and they didn't work, but then they soon realised that they could grow grapevines. Barley and hops, which are the two, you know, key essential ingredients for beer production, really didn't arrive in any meaningful way for a few years after that. So beer didn't really take off for a few decades into the colonial project. But by the mid 19th century, and then really, so the gold rush, when the population boomed, the demand for beer also boomed, and breweries started popping up everywhere, and people started growing barley and hops. So by the mid to late 19th century, there were hundreds and hundreds of breweries across the country. So, one of the reasons for that is the kind of beer that was being produced at that time, in before the 1880s, was ale. It was a strong, dark beer, nothing like the lager that has become the dominant style of beer since the Foster brothers introduced that to Australia in a successful way in the late 1880s. So a lot of those styles of beer that were produced before that didn't travel well. They didn't store well. They had to be drunk pretty close to the source. And that's why you had local breweries right across the country, wherever there were population centres.
Jarrah, hello.
Good morning, gentlemen. Good morning.
Yes, Jarrah.
I'm in Waratah in northwestern Tasmania. And our local pub, been here since the 1880s, we have an odd thing. I've not come across this before. A bottle of sarsaparilla sits on the bar, and it's put into a shot of sarsaparilla is put into beer.
You know, and because I can remember a shot of lime was popular in some places for a while, Max. Sometimes it was lemonade. I guess people had their own little versions of what a shandy was.
And why not? I think the idea of putting sweet, fruity flavours into beer to kind of make it more palatable goes back to the time when a lot of that beer that we drank wasn't fabulous, and you needed to kind of adulterate it with something. Sarsaparilla is not a drink you come across very often, is it?
No.
And I'm thinking that there's also that sarsaparilla is almost like a cola flavour. There's an aspect of that kind of cola flavour to it, which would make a beer a lot more, it might make it a lot more interesting to drink.
We're talking this morning with Max Allen, the author of Intoxicating 10 Drinks That Shaped Australia, and we're talking to you about the drinks that shaped you as well. Hello, Rod.
Hello, how are you going?
Yes, Rod.
I just wish my father was still alive. My dad used to make a really good 18-gallon keg. He was a cooper by trade.
Yeah.
And back in the old days, I believe that they used to make the kegs and put them all together, put the beer and the hops and, put all the water and all the material in the kegs. And by the time I went to the pub, they used to put it in the pubs down in the cool room, and then a week later they'd tap it and you'd have your beer.
I mean, how long ago would that have been, Max, when there were coopers making barrels?
Oh, there still are. They're not easy to find, but there's still a strong cooperage tradition in Australia. It's actually probably something that's got a lot more popular in commercial terms in the last few years with this new interest in whiskey production. All the whiskey distilleries want barrels to age their whiskey in. So if you're training as a cooper now, you're probably getting a lot of work. But remember what I was saying about there being local breweries, in every regional centre, and there's all the ancillary trades that would have gone along with that because, beer was aged in barrel very often at that time. I remember going to visit a couple of old Italians in Coburg, I think it was, or Preston in Melbourne about 20 years ago for a little TV segment, and these guys both used to work in the breweries, and they made their homemade wine in these little barrels that they'd recoopered themselves to kind of take the to take their wine. So they were pouring red wine out of a barrel that had come from, I think it was the Tooth's Brewery up in Sydney. So you had this weird situation of having this beer branded barrel, and yet it had red wine in it that these guys made. It was beautiful wine, actually.
We should talk about the rum and the Rum Rebellion and how rum became such a significant part of the early settlers in Australia. And I was interested to read that the rum wasn't what we know of a really nice Jamaican rum, but it was pretty foul.
Yeah. Yes, it was. It wasn't great stuff. So again, you know, everybody's got this. Everybody who grows up in Australia and you're taught about 1788, and you're taught about the Rum Rebellion, and you know, Bligh hiding under the bed because he was such a coward and wouldn't want to face up to the Marines and et cetera, et cetera. And so we had this perception that in 1788, when the first fleet arrived, they arrived with thousands and thousands of gallons of rum, because that's what people drank at the time. And when you say rum in Australia, as you say, you imagine this golden molasses-based drink like Bundy. You know, it's a rich, sweet, golden style of rum. But actually, if you go to the historical record, what the rum was that they brought over, what they bought in Rio on the way over, and it was more like a cane, sugar cane spirit, not a molasses spirit. So it would have been lighter in colour, thinner in body. And the reports of the time from the sailors and people on board described it as tasting pretty foul as well. So this idea that, you know, this perception that we have about our own history that we pick up along the way, it can actually not be correct. And very often when you go back to the original sources, you realize that it's a different way. And when you imagine this rough tasting spirit that came from Rio, it kind of certainly changes the way I see and think about that early history. It brings it to life. It gives it a kind of, I don't know, it changes my perception of what it must have been like to be in Sydney at that time.
It also changes the notion about it becoming such a major source of money. So it was a source of trade. It was a source of everything, and considering it was so horrible.
That was the first batch, obviously, as people started realizing there was a potential market here in Port Jackson, and the rum that came over and was traded and flooded the colony at the time. But again, even that wasn't what you expect. That was Bengal rum. So a lot of that was coming from India, because India was a major producer of rum at the time, and that rum was probably more like the arak that the Macassans brought back in the 17th century in style.
Ray, hello.
Hello, Trev and Max. I'm just saying that when the diggers come home from New Guinea, they are used to having brewing a jungle brew up there. And they used to make their own beer and wine. Well, mainly wine, because beer was very hard to conceal because of the fermentation time. But my friend had a vineyard, and he would make his wine, and he would bury it in little caves and little dugouts in the vineyard. And every so often the local sage would come for a raid because it was illegal, and he could never find it. But Bert had him beaten. But as far as the drinking goes, beer was very scarce, and to take a bottle of beer to a dance, which was illegal, it was bulky. So the pub sold a lot of flasks of whiskey, and I think there's Correo, and I believe I remember Bond 7 or something. And also rum was sold in coffee bottles. And you take that at the dance, and it was easy to put a 5-ounce flask of whiskey in your suitcase inside pocket, and you'd have a sip every so often. And it was, but when the brewing of the beer, my dad used to brew it, and very little expertise, and he would hide it behind the wardrobe in their mum and dad's bedroom, and because it was so potent, it used to blow the bottles. And he used to put a packing case across the top of them and put bricks on the packing case.
Pam, hello.
Hello. Barossa Pearl and Spumante.
Yep.
Were two drinks from the 60s that were sweet, white bubbly wine, absolutely terrible. and the name Spumante wasn't that good, was it? Now, no. The other thing, a flying fox was the word you were wanting for putting money to send across a department store.
Hang on, Pam, I've got it because we're only 3 minutes away from the news, and I wanted to just bring up the idea of opening times and closing times and how that affected the types of drinks that people were consuming and how they consumed it, Max.
So from the First World War until late into the 60s, I think, for many parts of Australia, we had 6 o'clock closing was introduced. In fact, if you go back into the historical record, we came very close to prohibition a couple of times. There were a couple of very well-supported prohibition referenda about the same time as it happened in America. So for many years, you know, this idea of this cosmopolitan drinking lifestyle that we enjoy now, where, you know, licensing is very relaxed. For a lot of people in the middle part of the century, yes, there was this idea that you've got to get your drinking finished in the pub before six, and it led to the 6 o'clock swill, which some people might remember, of having to get everything drunk by six. So people would, you know, line up at the bar and order multiple rounds of beer before closing time, which definitely affected our approach, I think, to drinking in Australia.
Did it also affect takeaways? Did it actually then affect what people took home and the types of alcohol they consumed then?
Well, you're looking at a very different time when beer and port and sherry were the drinks of choice. Beer would have been by far the most consumed style of drink in that situation, and you would have probably finished drinking at 6 o'clock in the pub and gone home and had a few more long necks at home, and probably how it would have worked.
Max, we haven't even gone into the wine industry and how that's changed through to now, which is a whole other story, which you cover beautifully in the book. Another thing that I found interesting was whether or not the wine industry takes any responsibility for overconsumption of wine as well. I just put, we're about a minute away from the news.
Yeah, we'll do that in a minute, shall we? We'll open the, crack that chestnut now. It's a perennial problem that's not going away, and it's actually been brought to the fore during this pandemic. You've got this tension between wanting people to drink responsibly and at the same time, you know, promoting alcohol to them. So how do you negotiate that problem of your licensee consumption of alcohol, and then you don't want to, well, you don't want people to drink too much. So yeah, it's a problem that the whole alcohol industry is grappling with.
Max, it is a fascinating book. I really enjoyed reading it. Thank you very much for telling us just a little bit about it on the program today.
Thanks for having me.
Max Allen, wine writer, journalist, and the author of Intoxicating, 10 Drinks That Shaped Australia. You're listening to Overnights on ABC Radio.